Great to have you with us for another edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, and today we're going to take a look to begin with a little bit at the climate, the changing climate. It's giving us more extreme weather. We get times of higher than average temperatures and lower than average precipitation, and then suddenly it floods. On Garden Talk today, we're going to look at how to deal with thirsty gardens. There are some areas of the state that have been pretty dry. And we'll also talk about growing sweet potatoes. And, of course, we'll answer your gardening questions, whatever they might be. VJ Pandian back with us. He is horticulture agent and educator for UW Extension. He works and serves Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. And we'll talk to VJ about dealing with dry gardens, maybe to start, and then, of course, want to hear from you. What gardening questions do you have for him? Join in. You can give us a call, the number 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. VJ Pandian, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Good to be on the show, Larry. How are you doing?
I am doing very, very well. We had some nice rain in fact, we had too much wind to go along with the rain. But I know it was dry in your part, you know, southeastern Wisconsin. And I'm wondering about the rain. Does it give you enough relief from the drought stress you were under?
Absolutely. A month ago, you know, we got one of the lowest precipitation, and this week, you know, the thunderstorm, you know, we got a pretty good amount of rain. And again, with the storm, you know, I knocked on some of the trees too and the branches. But yes, thankful for that and for all the rain that we got this week. And like you pointed out, you know, this fluctuating weather conditions to this extremes, you know, affects our garden plants in many ways, you know, and the plants will tell you, you know.
Yeah.
So it's just like, you know, you need to talk to your plants almost every day, you know, take a walk in your garden and observe your plants and see what type of signs and symptoms it shows you. And, you know, interestingly, you know, if you find that, you know, if your plants are, you know, let's say the weather is a bit dry for a week, and your plants will really tell you actually by showing some temporary wilting symptoms. And in the morning, you know, it'll be fine. In the later in the afternoon, it goes into a slight wilting phase. It's a way of plant telling you that, hey, I need some more moisture, and I'm going to go into this moisture conservation mode by shutting down, you know, my leaves. Instead of, you know, unfolding my leaves, I'm going to close my leaves down, you know, so it droops down. And in that way, it reduces its own evapotranspiration rate that happens up in the leaf tissue. So that is a good sign to tell you that, yes, the plant needs some moisture. In contrast, let's say, you know, if you have some, you know, heavy precipitation and, you know, like every other day or every day almost,
yeah,
you know, then you do have like a 3-4 days of, you know, standing water, then the plant will tell you that, you know, the entire plant system in 4-5 days, okay, let's talk about tomatoes or any vegetable crops, they will immediately will start to, you know, wilt completely. And that's because, you know, their root system is compromised with the lack of oxygen. Between the soil particles, they need to have some oxygen in it. But when the soil, you know, is completely, you know, compromised with some water, there's not enough oxygen left in the soil system, so for the roots to uptake. So that really collapses the entire plant. So the best thing, what you need to do as a gardener, as we move to this unpredictable weather scenario during the summertime, is to observe your plants every day in the morning, you know, and see how your plant responds to this kind of fluctuating weather condition. And then you can take some proper strategies how to mitigate these type of stress symptoms.
So if you've got a plant, let's say a tomato plant, just as an example, that is standing in water and it's I mean, is it? It's not too late to put in another plant, is it?
Well, it depends. Okay, the one thing, how long it's been standing in the water. Okay, because if it's like tomatoes are very finicky. Okay, and many vegetable crops are very finicky about all this in a stress. If it's like a standing water for more than 3-4 days. Okay. Then probably that's a very likely chance that their root system in it is depleted of oxygen and it has probably invited some of the root rotting pathogens in it. In that kind of scenario, when your plant goes into a wilting phase, it is best not to plant again in the same spot with the same species of plant. So what it means is that if your tomatoes are wilted in that spot because of overwatering or overflooding in the situation, do not stick the same tomato plant or eggplant or pepper plant in the same spot, okay? Try to switch to sometime different species. For example, you can plant some cucumbers or something else like that, because there's a likelihood that that might be a root rot pathogen very specific to the host plant. In the meantime, if it's not the 3 or 4 days, and if you caught it right away within like a couple of days that it's a standing water, try to find a way to channelize those excess water to a proper drainage system. You know, you don't want to have this overstanding water more than 2 days or 3 days, okay? Last year, I had a big container, and it's completely overfilled with the water because the drainage hole has been completely blocked. And I lost all my petunias in that. And if I had enough strength and ability, I would have actually right away flipped those things out, drained out some of the excess water and poked around to it. It's a large concrete container, as a gardener, if you do catch these things right away, it is best to drain those excess water, check if there is any drainage holes in the container, or a way to alter the drainage pattern if possible. So those are some ways, actually, you can catch those things at an early stage and prevent this collapse of your plant.
Hmm. So thinking about lawns, in the month of May, well, I usually don't get going with mowing my lawn until pretty late in May anyway. But under dry conditions, the lawns just kind of sit there, at least if they're not, at least the parts of the lawn that aren't shaded.
Absolutely. I mean, here in Southeast Wisconsin, it was very interesting that in the month of May, we had a little bit of a cooler weather. At the same time, it was a bit dry. And there were certain parts of my lawn, I thought it's almost going to go into dormancy mode. It started to show a slight symptom of it, and then glad the rain came in. And so when you do find these kind of extreme weather scenario, either a dry or too much moisture, especially in dry situation, I would say, you don't need to mow your lawn, okay? Let the lawn be itself. And so that's one good thing you can do. Second thing, you don't want to stress your lawn by adding more fertilizers or anything like that in those dry scenarios, because the lawns are not going to absorb any of those nutrients, because their whole survival mode is to go into dormancy mode to conserve their energy. So any using any excess fertilizers or any fertilizers is no good, and they're all going to get leached out or evaporated. So it's not good. And the third thing is that do not, walk in your lawn when the lawn has been very stressed out. You don't want to add any more stress stamping on it or doing any activities on your lawn. And at the same time, dormant lawns, it's a great thing for weeds. Weeds yeah. Gonna take over the advantage of it. I already seen some bindweeds, creeping, there's some other bird food trefoil, teasels, all swarmed in, on some of the stressed out lawns. So those are some of the things that you need to be aware about it when you have a really stressed out lawn under dry conditions.
We don't think about our trees maybe as much as we should during dry conditions. What are your thoughts with relating to trees and probably shrubs too?
Absolutely. I mean, a lot of times people underestimate how much transpiration rate increases up during the 80-85 degree weather conditions. Trees transpire a lot of water. under in a 85 to 90 degrees weather condition, especially if you do have trees next to any radiating buildings or driveways or concrete, you know, or pavements. And when those kind of, you know, heat stress period, in a one thing absolutely is needed is to water your trees. Keep your trees very healthy and especially the root system to be cool and moist. Say, water your trees on a regular basis, maybe, you know, if, especially if it's a young tree with us, like we are planted within recently in 5 years, water them 2 times a week. And if it's a mature tree, probably once a week, I would say. You can use a soaker hose system. That's really a nice thing. You know, you place your soaker hose around your base of your tree and set a timer to it, you know, from 45 minutes to 1 hour, you know, and then mulch on top of it. And keep your mulch to about 3 inches, you know, in deep, and keep the mulch about a few inches away from the base of the tree as well. So watering trees is very helpful. It'll really mitigate a lot of stress, especially even during in the winter time. You know, you got these sun scald, frost damages. All those things could be mitigated by watering your trees during in the growing season. And of course, any type of, you know, vascular wilt diseases could also be mitigated by keeping your trees very healthy during in the summer period.
Yeah, this to kind of go along with trees, I was walking through the neighborhood and I saw I felt bad about it. It was an oak tree with one of its branches had gotten knocked off. And it was just a couple, you know, a day ago. And we're not supposed to be doing anything with oak trees right now in terms of trimming. And I wondered what the person was going to do about it. It was too early in the day to talk to them, go knock on the door and ask. But this might be one time where if you've got a branch like that, you actually would want to coat that area.
Absolutely. There are some exceptions, extraordinary cases, like, you know, when you feel that, you know, some of the branches has been broken or is actually in a, seems to be more hazardous in nature. Okay. And it's a good possibility that it's going to cause some sort of like any damages to your property, or it's dangling in such a situation that it needs to be trimmed. Yes, you can trim them. First of all, identify, you know, whether it is safe for you to trim it, or you better hire a professional certified arborist to do those jobs. Okay. If you feel that it is safe for you to do it, identify the limb and, you know, use a 3-point cut method, which basically is that first, if the limbs are more than 2 inches in diameter, few inches above that damaged areas, you know, or maybe close to the base of its attachment, make an undercut, and then in a few inch above it, make a cut all the way down, and then go to its point of attachment and make a sharp, clean cut. There is an extension publication. You can Google up 3-way point cut method, UW extension, and you can download that fact sheet, and that'll give you a clear picture view of how to make this cut. Now, if you're not sure and you're not in a confident enough to do this kind of cutting, leave it to a professional arborist. You can find a list of certified arborists at Wisconsin Arborist Association, and they have a tab, Find a Pro. You can find it based on your locality. Now, when you do make any of those cuts on either on elms as well as oaks during the growing season, right at the cut end, you can definitely use a pruning paint, and that to deter actually any sap-sucking beetles getting attracted to it. And the thing is that during in the growing season, especially in oaks, that is always a threat of oak wilt diseases, and one of the vector that carries this is sap beetles, which attracts towards any the smell of the saps dripping from the cut ends. And to avoid that, that's the only cases the pruning paint is recommended during in the growing season.
BJ Pandy and our guest, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties, talking what to do in the garden this time of the year. And I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments. Number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Talking gardening today with VJ Pandian, our horticulture extension educator. It's great to have him with us. And again, you can join in 800-642-1234, email to talk@wpr.org. Got an email from Lynn in Pewaukee. Her peonies started to bloom. There are 3 to 4 flowers, but now the undeveloped buds have dried up. Is the May drought to blame for this?
Well, it may be possible, or it could be also a sign of botrytis blight disease, okay, that also affects some of the peony bush. Peonies tends to, is more vulnerable to this particular disease, okay, and the disease could really affect, you know, the blossom as well. So one thing I would do is to take a photograph and send it to Dr. Brian Huddleston's lab, and, you know, see, you know, if there is any signs and symptoms of any botrytis blights that might be affecting some of the buds, you know, developing buds. And if it's usually, if it's a dry related thing, you know, probably those buds actually will start to wilt. You will see a signs of it. But I'm really suspecting it might be one of those pathogens like botrytis blight.
Oh, so get a photo, Lynn, if you can, and send it to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, UW Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic. You can type that in, and there's a simply send the photo to Brian Huddleston, Dr. Death, and he can look at it. If you get a couple of different shots, it'd probably be a good thing, and it's something that's fairly quick and easy to do. So there you go. I was going to ask you a question here about planting natives, but Dee in Milwaukee has something, and I think I'd rather go to her, to Dee for the moment. Dee, hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure. What's on your mind?
Well, we've got several trees that have probably been planted by squirrels growing along our foundation. We've tried digging them out, probably left some root in there. I tried Roundup on the little tree trunks, and I just can't get rid of them. They're coming back year after year. So I'm wondering, aside from digging out the whole garden area, is there a way to kill or remove these little, probably have 6 or 8 of them, and they're probably up to about 2 feet tall.
Hmm.
Wow. Are they all black walnut, or do you know what type of seedling it is? It's like a box elder or what?
I couldn't tell you specifically. We've got in our neighborhood nearby, we've got maples. It looks like one might be a chestnut. I can't really identify them. I'm not certain what they are.
Hmm.
Well, one other thing is that, you know, a lot of times in the landscape, some of those Norway maples, when they shed their, you know, what you call samaras, like a helicopter pods, okay, and the next year they all sprout out, okay, and they say one of the best way to knock them out is to mow them down. Either use a string trimmer or any type of like a mower and cut them down at the young seedling stage. When they get about like 6 inches, when you cut them down, or even younger stage, okay, then, you know, you will able to save a lot of headaches down the road. You know, that's one of the best way, easy way to catch them. But if you let them keep growing, and unfortunately, if it's getting close to the foundation of your house, okay, one thing you need to do, especially if you're using any type of non-selective product like, you know, glyphosate, is that fall is the best time to spray for it. In the fall time, you know, those solutions get down to the root system and affects and kills the plant. That doesn't mean that, you know, during the growing season, you can, you know, you don't want to see those plants simply sitting and growing in front of you. What I would tend to do is that take a string trimmer and knock them down close to the ground as much as possible. In that way, you're weakening the plant. And if it still persists and if it keeps coming back, and in the fall, then you take one more thing by spraying a non-selective herbicide, and then you knock them down.
After you've made a new cut in those. Yep. Yeah. So it's one of those things of you just got to kind of keep at it. And you've been going for a while, Dee, but you're going to need more now. I'd be chopping them down and then keeping them. And whenever they start to come back up, hit them right when they're little. That's for sure. Thank you very much for calling. Again, you can join us 800-642-1234 or email to talk@wpr.org. Did have a question from a listener about mulches. What mulches are, or what are you recommending, or what are your thoughts on mulch? Are there mulches that help retain water better than others, I guess is the question.
Well, there are two main roles, are the purpose of, using for mulch. One is to conserve your soil moisture. And second thing also help in, by conserving the soil moisture, it also helps in cooling the root system. And in addition, indirectly, it also helps in smothering some of the annual weeds, And so these are the 2 to 3, roles the mulch plays. Now, the role of these mulches could be effectively done, depends upon the type of mulch, as well as, how much you're applying around the base of the trees or shrubs. So let me get to the first one, how much to apply. Generally, about like a 3-inch would be really good during in the growing season. And make sure to keep those mulch, especially around those trees, about like a few inches, 4 to 6 inches away from the base of the tree. So, and then you can spread it as much as you want till to the drip line area of the tree that you can do. That will really help the tree, help the trees very much. And in terms of also conserving the moisture, but in terms of type of mulch, whether one mulch is better than the other one, let me, twist this question a little bit differently. What type of mulch should not be applied? Let me answer that.
Okay.
That would make you more sense. Okay. So first thing, you need to be very cautious about getting any free mulch, especially from, city yard waste or something like that, because the thing is that sometimes those wood chips and the mulch, we don't know what type of, vascular pathogens they are still carrying on. So a lot of time when all those arborists or the municipal foresters, they trim down the trees and they shred those barks, those trees might already be infected with verticillium wilt diseases and stuff like that. According to our plant pathologist, Dr. Brian Huddleston, some of those verticillium wilt diseases can thrive on some of those shredded bark and mulch for at least for a year. If it's like a fresh mulch like these things that has not been healed in, you need to be very cautious about those things, And so just be aware about it. And second of all, make sure those free mulches are weed-free. You don't want to bring in any bindweeds and thistles and all those weeds, contaminated weeds, into your garden or your landscape. Then it becomes another big headache for you. So be aware about those two things. And you don't want to get any of those mulches mixed in with some poison ivies and stuff like that, especially from wooded areas either. So just be aware about that. So being said that, in terms of, one mulch is better than the other one, well, if you apply, any of those wood chips or bark mulches, or a cypress mulches and all those things, most of these mulches last for at least for a season or so. So some of the cypress mulches may last a little bit longer. So definitely I would recommend, any of those wood chip mulches, and bark mulches, that you can use. It doesn't matter if it's a pine bark mulches or cedar mulches or any of those things. So in terms of, the longevity of these mulches, it depends, if cedar or cypress mulches, they last a little bit longer. Few things I would also avoid. One is nowadays they're selling a lot of rubber mulches. Rubber mulches, as you know, they're not organic and they don't have any necessary role to conserve the soil moisture. So only it's for decorative purpose, or if you want to walk on the top of it, you can use it. So avoid that.
Yeah. Lots of good information there. Rebecca in Madison has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I have a small yard in Madison, and we bought the house about 4 years ago and inherited a Freeman's maple, I'm pretty sure is what it is. It doesn't seem to shed seeds, but it's just gotten really big over time, and we've kind of debated cutting it down or leaving it. Nice to have the shade, but just curious about advice on these kinds of trees in urban environments and recommendations for cutting down.
Hmm.
That's a very good question. And I'm glad that you asked this question. The reason is that many times in urban areas, when you select a tree, we typically see based on the canopy, whether the canopy is full, green, what color it forms, okay? But we need to look a little bit beyond that. We need to look whether those canopy have a good branching structure. So many cultivars of Freeman maples, they are notorious to have actually multiple branches coming in from one point of their trunk. And that leads to an included bark formation. They don't have a good, strong branching angle and becomes more prone to any storm damages and can't able to withstand any ice and snow weight as well. And it becomes a big headache when the tree becomes very mature at 25, 30 years, okay? It shows all this kind of cavities to breaking branches and stuff like that. So one thing I would say in future, when you're going to select a tree, look beyond the canopy and the fall coloration, see if those trees have a good branching structure. What I mean by branching structure is that a tree should have a good, strong central leader, and the main branches should have at least about 60 to 90 degree angles. They should be more like a U-shaped angle. See if those branches of those tree species and the cultivars fit to those categories, okay, and select based on it. Now, going back to your original question, your tree is a large tree and, it's shedding all these things and it has this kind of, you're debating whether to remove it or not. One thing, you need to hire a professional certified arborist. That arborist needs to have on-site to do assess your tree, whether the branching structures are good, are there any signs of any decay happening up inside your tree, and are there any possibilities of any diseases happening up in your tree. So those things, a professional arborist, when they come down to your site and make a site visit and analyze those things, they can able to give you a recommendation whether it is best to leave the tree for another few more years, or just from safety perspective, it is better to cut it down. Or maybe they may think about maybe trimming some of those few branches to improve the branching structures. They can give you all those kind of assessments. Over the phone, it's very tough. So do go to Wisconsin Arborist Association's website and type in your zip code, okay, on the professional, find an arborist professional. And based on your locality, there will be a lot of list of certified arborists. And you can call a couple of them, check what the price range is, and then schedule an appointment with them.
All good advice there, Rebecca. And thank you very much for calling. Corey in Dodgeville has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Corey.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. I just want to let you listeners know that a great opportunity this Saturday and throughout the rest of the summer to buy native plants, which are, of course, very drought resilient, in near Broadhead, Wisconsin. There's a little open-air self-help shop at a nature preserve, and that nature preserve is Three Waters Reserve, and that shop is opening tomorrow, and there'll be staff on hand to help everyone from 9 to 1 tomorrow, and then most of the rest of the season, it's self-help. Just drop on in anytime and help yourself.
Oh, so that's Three Waters Reserve near Broadhead.
Near Broadhead, and the nursery is Bombus, B-O-M-B-U-S, but yes, this weekend there's a big event happening out there. It'll be a great opportunity. There are native perennials, trees, and shrubs there.
Corey, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Always nice to hear about those, VJ.
Absolutely. I mean, in these kind of extreme weather conditions, native plants in the are excellent alternatives, especially in dry situations. They are adaptable in our regions. A few things to consider when you're going to select any of your native plants. Check the orientation, you know, whether your whether your landscape site location is sun shade or pot shade or something like that. And also consider, you know, what is the bloom time and the height of it, okay? And there are a lot of drought-tolerant native plants available in Wisconsin, you know, including like, you know, one of my favorite one would be is the, you know, as usual, the black-eyed Susan, the drought-tolerant one. In late summertime, in fall time, you know, they are very stunning looking. Of course, you know, you can also use, you know, the blazing star as well too. The milkweed, especially the butterfly milkweed, which is a gorgeous, you know, orangish blossom in the middle of the summertime. So besides offering the drought-tolerant characteristic, many of these native ones have an excellent blooming colors, and they also support a lot of pollinators, actually, too. So, yes.
TJ in Madison has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, TJ.
Hey, how you doing, Larry?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, so I've got a pretty mature maple. I would say it's at least 25 years old in my backyard. And right down the middle of the trunk, I don't know if it got struck by lightning at some point, but there's basically a split just like, and I'm afraid that one day half the tree is just going to like fall over and then the tree will die. Is there anything I can do to sort of, you know, bind that crack or try to repair the tree and prolong its life?
Yeah, that's a good question. Okay. First of all, take a photograph of that split, okay? And you can send it out to a certified arborist, okay, to get their opinion in terms of, you know, whether it's still safe to have the tree or it is better to cut it down, okay? Now, the reason I'm telling you is that most of the time when you do have a split, it depends upon what is the cause of the split and to what degree the split has happened, how wide the split has happened, and whether something can be done to fix it up. So, let me go to the cause of the split. So, first of all, on a mature maple tree, one of the primary causes would be also due to the stem girdling root. So when the trees are planted deeply, one of the roots might choke at one of the base region of the tree, and it literally restricts the movement of water uptake. That area you're going to find as very sunken depression in that region of the trunk of the tree, and that makes it vulnerable to any frost or winter damages and causes a split. Second possibility is that naturally, you know, when we have a fluctuating winter weather, they usually cause, we call, you know, sunscald injury, which causes like a narrow split. And that narrow split widens up later during in the winter time. And usually you find that type of split happening on the bark of the tree that faces south side. And that's typically of sunscald injury. The third type is suddenly if there is a frost happening up in the middle of the winter time where the temperature drops down all of a sudden from 50 degrees to immediately to 20 degrees or suddenly even less than 20, then you're going to have a tiny vertical split happening. So there are three different possibilities how a split could happen. And once a split happens up, there are a lot of pathogens, decay-causing pathogens, get inside the split and start to, you know, rupture your heartwood of the tree. The heartwood of the tree provides a main stability. They are the basic skeleton that stabilizes your tree's growth, upright growth. And if that heartwood gets compromised, then probably it's a matter of time the tree is going to fall down. So to what extent the inner heartwood is compromised, you know, that's something a certified arborist can let you know. So they do some sort of like a acoustic type of analysis. They use like a wooden mallet and then tap it. And based on the sound that emits from those, you know, the tree, they can able to let you know. say to the depending upon the degree of the split, how wide the split is, and to what extent the pathogen has got inside the heartwood of the tree, say they will recommend, you know, whether it is immediately these trees needs to be taken down, or maybe the tree has another 4 or 5 years to, you know, to withstand, and then maybe we can think about replacing it later on. So in terms of the tree naturally sealing those split, the chances are very unlikely. Only in certain cases, if the split is a narrow split, and only to it happens in a very small wide range, then they can treat and naturally form a callus tissue and close those wounds, okay? But if the split has been there for a few years and you start to see some decay symptoms like oozing, blackish color formations, you know, that seems to be happening up on the split areas. In those cases, that split has, you know, the pathogen's already got into the, you know, the inner part of the wood, and it's a matter of time the tree is going to, you know, get damaged by the storm. So it is better to call a certified arborist and call a couple of them to get their opinion, and then you can make a wise decision based out of it.
TJ, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. We had an email from Stu and Randolph, and this related to the previous caller who was trying to get rid of trees growing along her foundation. Stu suggested she use 2,4-D or brush killer.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I mean, the thing is that the 2,4-D works very well when it's like a young seedlings, okay? Like about like a, you know, 2 to 4 inches, okay? Anything more than like a 12 inches, 2,4-D doesn't show that much of, you know, effectiveness. Brush killer usually have a mixture of triclopyr as well as sometimes glufosinate into it or glyphosate into it as well too. Now, the brush killer works very effectively it's a non-selective, you know, sometimes it's a non-selective product, and it depends upon where you're applying. And so it is also effective in the fall season. That's where, you know, the most of the products gets into the root system.
VJ Pandian, our guest today, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Questions for him, give a call, the number 800-642-1234, or you could email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on WPR News. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Just a quick note, in the next hour, Erwin Goldman and Jim Nienhuis are back together as the Vicars of Vegetables, and we'll be talking gardening with them. And if you've got a haiku related to a vegetable or a flower, you might start working on that, because I'm sure we'll have some questions relating or some. We'll be looking forward to what you have for a haiku. 5 syllables, 7 syllables, and 5 syllables. So that's a haiku. I wanted to mention tomorrow I will be judging the Baraboo Big Top Parade in Baraboo, Wisconsin. Going to be a lot of fun. I'm one of 3 judges, and we'll be, I think it starts at 11 o'clock, the parade itself, and runs for an hour or so, maybe an hour and a half. And I'm looking forward to meeting some WPR listeners and doing a little judging of the floats that go by. So that's tomorrow. And then on Sunday, I'll be at the Madison Mallards. It's Larry Mueller Day at the Madison Mallards on Sunday. And I get to throw out the first pitch. And 60 feet, 6 inches, you know, that's from the pitcher's mound to the plate. And I practiced last night a little bit. And I was not as successful as I figured I would be. I played a lot of ball in my life. So anyway, and we'll have an exhibit. We'll have a booth there, and I'll be shaking some hands at the opening, and then I'll be throwing out the first pitch and I guess making some comments during one of the innings as well. So lots going on for me this weekend, Saturday at Baraboo, and then Sunday at the Madison Mallards baseball game. Going to be a lot of fun. I hope in my arm I can get the ball across the plate. Well, I'll give it my best. Right now, we're talking with VJ Pandian, horticulture extension educator, and you can join in. 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Let's take a call from John in Algoma. John, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's great to hear your program yet again. And hi to BJ as well. Really appreciate the advice. I had a question about dealing with the damage that's been done by the emerald ash borer. I lived on the Door Peninsula, and a very large proportion, in some cases 50, 60, 70% of the trees, particularly in our swampy areas, which we used to call the black ash, but now are almost treeless. The question is, what can be done to basically reforest those areas? I mean, should we be considering some sort of aerial broadcasting of seeds, or is it going to be have to be hand replanted? I mean, the trick being, of course, that most of these areas are very wet, sometimes impossibly wet. People only go into them to cut firewood and harvest wood for lumber in the wintertime when everything is frozen over hard and you can easily get to the trees. But at this point, we just have all of these dead trees all over the county.
Yeah, it's too bad, John. Thanks for calling. What do you think, VJ?
Well, so we are learning actually quite a bit from Michigan, because that's where, you know, the EAB was found back in that, you know, early 2000s, okay? And interestingly, what's been happening is that, you know, of course, the EAB, when it knocked down in a, some of those in a decent size in a ash trees, the young ash trees, it did not touch. So less than like 2 inches in DBH, okay, something like that, okay. So there are a lot of, you know, seed banks of, you know, ash tree seeds, okay, are left in the soil over the years. And once those, you know, spaces opened up, you're going to see a lot of those young ash tree seedlings popping out. Now, whether those trees will be alive to reach that mature stage, it's very unlikely because of the EAB. And whether we're going to have any natural predators that has been released actually to counter it in that time period, not sure yet, you know, but there are certain parasitic wasps available still. They are floating around, but it takes its own time to build this population to counteract that. So in this kind of scenario, certainly it's possible to do some replanting options. And so one other thing to do is to reach out to your local conservation department. So most counties do have conservation department, and they do sell some, you know, native tree species seedlings in the springtime. And as a team or with your local communities, okay, or with the school kids, you can do some, you know, teamwork effort into replanting certain section of those areas with those seedlings. You can get those seedlings at a very decent price through the conservation department, and especially for communal projects, they will 100% will support those things. And so you can select some diverse species and you can do those things rather than doing some aerial seeding that could be more expensive, and then it takes a lot of logistical work trying to get the, you know, the State Department approval and all those things. But you can partner with other local, you know, nonprofit organizations, schools, and other, you know, organizations to do some replanting option, you know, and get the necessary permission from the DNR to do reforest those areas. Yes.
John, good luck with that. Thank you so much for calling. And Jake in Brussels, we'll go to you. Thank you, Jake.
Yes. How can I cut tree roots that are growing towards the house for a Norway maple?
Oh, God, gosh. Okay. Well, here's the thing. Well, one thing you need to ask yourself, why this particular limb or the branch is going towards your house, okay? And more likely, it's either possibly, you know, that's where the most of the light has been taking place, and that's why the branches are moving towards that area. There's an open space, there's a lot of light, so this particular branch might be, you know, creeping up in that area. The second possibility, you know, it could be is that, you know, your other branching patterns, you know, instead of take a closer look, you know, on your tree, how your other branching patterns are structured. Sometimes, you know, when one limb has been failed, and then the possibility that it'll trigger the other limb to grow in the other direction, and that could be, you know, accidentally going towards your house too. So, you know, if you're worried about, you know, this particular limb's going towards your house and going to pose more hazardous in situation, you need to be very careful before trimming that particular branch, because you don't want to offset the balance of your branching canopies. So what I would suggest to do is to take a photograph, send it to a certified arborist, and ask their opinion about it, okay, and see if it's appropriate to trim that particular branch. In most cases, sometimes many arborists, what they may tend to do is that you can do a reduction cut. Basically, what it means is that you don't cut the entire branch in a single season. You trim it gradually over the years. So you take, you know, one-third probably for this year, another one-third next year, another one-third in the following year. In that way, it doesn't, you know, upset the tree. And at the same time, it may not, you know, throw off your other branching structure balance off either. So that's another possibility to think about it. But needless, whatever it is, talk to a professional arborist, ask the arborist to do a site visit, do a consult with them by sharing the photograph of the branching and of the entire tree branching structure, and, you know, get their opinion before you start thinking about trimming that limb to that's going towards your house.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Jake, thank you very much for calling. Vijay, I heard tell that you have a question for me.
Well, absolutely. You know, first of all, congratulations on your upcoming retirement. you know, we're all going to miss you, you know, among the thousands of gardeners around the state and beyond. We're all certainly going to miss you. We all enjoy your talk show, and it's very informative. But I do have a question, you know, because in my short career span, I've been in with Extension for almost 25 years, but I've been seeing a trend is that, you know, for the first few years, there'll be a trend about gardening, vegetable gardening, and then next few years, there's going to be a trend about trees and shrubs, and then the natives. And, you know, it's like a big circle that's taking place. But you've been hosting this WPR Garden Talk Show since 1967, you know, and long, long time, even before my birth, okay? So what are some of the major gardening trends at the time and how they evolved over the course of your career? I'm very curious to learn about it.
Oh, man. Well, you know, back in the day, when I was a little kid, I mean, we didn't know anything other than organic, for the most part, organic gardening. And then, of course, there was quite a long spell where we were more chemically oriented. And now we're back to, I think, more people are interested in the organic gardening. So that's one thing. Another thing, I think, is native landscaping. I mean, it comes to mind because Neil DeBull was on the show a few weeks back from Prairie Nursery and talking about when he started 40 years ago, people thought he was nuts to talk about native plants. People didn't consider them as part of their landscape, their professional landscape. So I think native landscaping has really come to the fore in Wisconsin and across the country. So those are at least a couple of changes that I've seen. The other, of course, climate change is really, I mean, our hardiness zones have been changing for a long time. And Vijay, it's been a pleasure for me to work with you. Thank you so much. I'll be listening in on Garden Talk to hear what you've got to say next time around. Thanks, Vijay.
Thank you, Larry. Thanks so much for having me.
BJ Pandian, horticulture extension educator for Kenosha, Milwaukee, and Racine counties. Well, coming up next are Vicars of Vegetables. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News and Garden Talk.